Epilogue. My goal in writing this book has been to help close the door to a certain style of irrationality. While religious faith is the one species of human ignorance that will not admit of even the possibility of correction, it is still sheltered from criticism in every corner of our culture. Forsaking all valid sources of information about this world, both spiritual and mundane, our religions have seized upon ancient taboos and pre-scientific fancies as though they held ultimate metaphysical significance. Books that embrace the narrowest spectrum of political, moral, scientific, and spiritual understanding, books that, by their antiquity alone, offer us the most dilute wisdom with respect to the present, are still dogmatically thrust upon us as the final word on matters of the greatest significance. In the best case, faith leaves otherwise well-intentioned people incapable of thinking rationally about many of their deepest concerns. At worst, it is a continuous source of human violence. Even now, many of us are motivated not by what we know, but by what we are content merely to imagine. Many are still eager to sacrifice happiness, compassion, and justice in this world for a fantasy of a world to come. These and other degradations await us along the well-worn path of piety. Whatever our religious differences may mean for the next life, they have only one terminus in this one, a future of ignorance and slaughter. We live in societies that are still constrained by religious laws and threatened by religious violence. What is it about us, and specifically about our discourse with one another, that keeps these astonishing bits of evil loose in our world? We have seen that education and wealth are insufficient guarantors of rationality. Indeed, even in the West, educated men and women still cling to the blood-soaked heirlooms of a previous age. Mitigating this problem is not merely a matter of reining in a minority of religious extremists. It is a matter of finding approaches to ethics and to spiritual experience that make no appeal to faith, and broadcasting this knowledge to everyone. Of course, one senses that the problem is simply hopeless. What could possibly cause billions of human beings to reconsider their religious beliefs? And yet, it is obvious that an utter revolution in our thinking could be accomplished in a single generation, if parents and teachers would merely give honest answers to the questions of every child. Our doubts about the feasibility of such a project should be tempered by an understanding of its necessity, for there is no reason whatsoever to think that we can survive our religious differences indefinitely. Imagine what it would be like for our descendants to experience the fall of civilization. Imagine failures of reasonableness so total that our largest bombs finally fall upon our largest cities, in defense of our religious differences. What would it be like for the unlucky survivors of such a Holocaust to look back upon the hurtling career of human stupidity that led them over the precipice? A view from the end of the world would surely find that the 6 billion of us currently alive did much to pave the way to the apocalypse. This world is simply ablaze with bad ideas. There are still places where people are put to death for imaginary crimes, like blasphemy, and where the totality of a child's education consists of his learning to recite from an ancient book of religious fiction. There are countries where women are denied almost every human liberty, except the liberty to breed. And yet, these same societies are quickly acquiring terrifying arsenals of advanced weaponry. If we cannot inspire the developing world, and the Muslim world in particular, to pursue ends that are compatible with a global civilization, then a dark future awaits all of us. The contest between our religions is zero sum. Religious violence is still with us because our religions are intrinsically hostile to one another. Where they appear otherwise, it is because secular knowledge and secular interests are restraining the most lethal improprieties of faith. It is time we acknowledge that no real foundation exists within the canons of Christianity, Islam, Judaism, or any of our other faiths, for religious tolerance and religious diversity. If religious war is ever to become unthinkable for us in the way that slavery and cannibalism seem poised to, it will be a matter of our having dispensed with the dogma of faith. If our tribalism is ever to give way to an extended moral identity, our religious beliefs can no longer be sheltered from the tides of genuine inquiry and genuine criticism. It is time we realized that to presume knowledge where one has only pious hope is a species of evil. Wherever conviction grows in inverse proportion to its justification, we have lost the very basis of human cooperation. Where we have reasons for what we believe, we have no need of faith. Where we have no reasons, we have lost both our connection to the world and to one another. People who harbor strong convictions without evidence belong at the margins of our societies, not in our halls of power. The only thing we should respect in a person's faith is his desire for a better life in this world. We need never have respected his certainty that one awaits him in the next. Nothing is more sacred than the facts. No one, therefore, should win any points in our discourse for deluding himself. The litmus test for reasonableness should be obvious. Anyone who wants to know how the world is, whether in physical or spiritual terms, will be open to new evidence. We should take comfort in the fact that people tend to conform themselves to this principle whenever they are obliged to. This will remain a problem for religion. The very hands that prop up our faith will be the ones to shake it. It is as yet undetermined what it means to be human, because every facet of our culture, and even our biology itself, remains open to innovation and insight. We do not know what we will be 1,000 years from now, or indeed that we will be, given the lethal absurdity of many of our beliefs. But whatever changes await us, one thing seems unlikely to change. As long as experience endures, the difference between happiness and suffering will remain our paramount concern. We will therefore want to understand those processes, biochemical, behavioral, ethical, political, economic, and spiritual, that account for this difference. We do not yet have anything like a final understanding of such processes, but we know enough to rule out many false understandings. Indeed, we know enough at this moment to say that the God of Abraham is not only unworthy of the immensity of creation, he is unworthy even of man. We do not know what awaits each of us after death, but we know that we will die. Clearly, it must be possible to live ethically, with a genuine concern for the happiness of other sentient beings, without presuming to know things about which we are patently ignorant. Consider it. Every person you have ever met, every person you will pass in the street today, is going to die. Living long enough, each will suffer the loss of his friends and family. All are going to lose everything they love in this world. Why would one want to be anything but kind to them in the meantime? We are bound to one another. The fact that our ethical institutions must, in some way, supervene upon our biology does not make ethical truths reducible to biological ones. We are the final judges of what is good, just as we remain the final judges of what is logical, and on neither front has our conversation with one another reached an end. There need be no scheme of rewards and punishments transcending this life to justify our moral intuitions or to render them effective in guiding our behavior in the world. The only angels we need invoke are those of our better nature, reason, honesty, and love. The only demons we must fear are those that lurk inside every human mind, ignorance, hatred, greed, and faith, which is surely the devil's masterpiece. Man is manifestly not the measure of all things. This universe is shot through with mystery. The very fact of its being, and of our own, is a mystery absolute, and the only miracle worthy of the name. The consciousness that animates us is itself central to this mystery, and the ground for any experience we might wish to call spiritual. No myths need be embraced for us to commune with the profundity of our circumstance. No personal God need be worshipped for us to live in awe at the beauty and immensity of creation. No tribal fictions need be rehearsed for us to realize one fine day that we do, in fact, love our neighbors, that our happiness is inextricable from their own, and that our interdependence demands that people everywhere be given the opportunity to flourish. The days of our religious identities are clearly numbered. Whether the days of civilization itself are numbered would seem to depend, rather too much, on how soon we realize this. Afterward. The human psyche has two great sicknesses, the urge to carry vendetta across generations, and the tendency to fasten group labels on people rather than see them as individuals. Abrahamic religion gives strong sanction to both, and mixes explosively with both. Only the willfully blind could fail to implicate the divisive force of religion in most, if not all, of the violent enmities in the world today. Without a doubt, it is the prime aggravator of the Middle East. Those of us who have for years politely concealed our contempt for the dangerous collective delusion of religion need to stand up and speak out. Things are different now. All is changed. Changed utterly. Richard Dawkins. It has been nearly a year since The End of Faith was first published in the United States. In response, I have received a continuous correspondence from readers and non-readers alike, expressing everything from ecstatic support to nearly homicidal condemnation. Many thousands of people have apparently read the book, and millions more have heard its contents discussed in the media. In response, letters and emails have come to me from scientists and physicians at every stage of their careers, from soldiers fighting in Iraq, from Christian ministers who have lost their faith, and from those who haven't, from Muslims who agree with my general disparagement of their religion, and from others who would have me meet them at a local mosque so that I might better learn the will of God. I have also heard from hundreds of embattled free thinkers living in Red State America. Judging from this last group of correspondents, the American heartland is fast becoming as blinkered as the wilds of Afghanistan. It may be too much to hope that the efforts of reasonable people will yet turn the tide. According to several recent polls, 22% of Americans are certain that Jesus will return to Earth sometime in the next 50 years. Another 22% believe that he will probably do so. This is likely the same 44% who go to church once a week or more, who believe that God literally promised the land of Israel to the Jews, and who want to stop teaching children about the biological fact of evolution. Believers of this sort constitute the most cohesive and motivated segment of the American electorate. Consequently, their views and prejudices now influence almost every decision of national importance. Political liberals seem to have drawn the wrong lesson from these developments, and are now thumbing scripture, wondering how best to ingratiate themselves to the legions of men and women in our country who vote mainly on the basis of religious dogma. More than 50% of Americans have a negative or highly negative view of people who do not believe in God. 70% think it important for presidential candidates to be strongly religious. Because it is taboo to criticize a person's religious beliefs, political debate over questions of public policy, stem cell research, the ethics of assisted suicide and euthanasia, obscenity and free speech, gay marriage, etc., generally gets framed in terms appropriate to a theocracy. Unreason is now ascendant in the United States, in our schools, in our courts, and in each branch of the federal government. Only 28% of Americans believe in evolution. 72% believe in angels. Ignorance in this degree, concentrated in both the head and the belly of a lumbering superpower, is now a problem for the entire world. Having seen my argument against faith discussed, attacked, celebrated, and misconstrued in blogs and book reviews throughout the world, I would like to take the occasion of its release in paperback as an opportunity to respond to the most common criticisms and misconceptions. These are by no means straw man arguments. These are what real people, and the occasional book reviewer, believe to be devastating retorts to my basic thesis. 1. Yes, religion occasionally causes violence, but the greatest crimes of the 20th century were perpetrated by atheists. Godlessness, as witnessed by the regimes of Hitler, Stalin, Mao, Pol Pot, and Kim Jong-il, is the most dangerous condition of all. This is one of the most common criticisms I encounter. It is also the most depressing, as I anticipate and answer it early in the book. While some of the most despicable political movements in human history have been explicitly irreligious, they were not especially rational. The public pronouncements of these regimes have been mere litanies of delusion about race, economics, national identity, the march of history, or the moral dangers of intellectualism. Auschwitz, the Gulag, and the killing fields are not examples of what happens when people become too critical of unjustified beliefs. To the contrary, these horrors testify to the dangers of not thinking critically enough about specific secular ideologies. Needless to say, my argument against religious faith is not an argument for the blind embrace of atheism as a dogma. The problem I raise in the book is none other than the problem of dogma itself, of which every religion has more than its fair share. I know of no society in human history that ever suffered because its people became too reasonable. As I argue throughout the book, certainty without evidence is necessarily divisive and dehumanizing. In fact, respect for evidence and rational argument is what makes peaceful cooperation possible. As human beings, we live in a perpetual choice between conversation and violence. What, apart from a fundamental willingness to be reasonable, can guarantee that we will keep talking to one another? 2. We need faith to do almost anything. It is absurd to think that we could ever do without it. One email I received on this subject began, "I like your writing style, but you are an idiot." Fair enough. My correspondent then went on to point out, as many have, that each of us has to get out of bed in the morning and live his life, and we do this in a context of uncertainty, and in the context of terrible certainties, like the certainty of death. This positive disposition, this willingness to set a course in life without any assurance that things will go one's way, is occasionally called faith. Thus, one may prop up a disconsolate friend with the words, "Have faith in yourself." Such words are almost never facetious, even on the forked tongue of an atheist. Let me state for the record that I see nothing wrong with this kind of faith. But this is not the faith that has given us religion. It would be rather remarkable if a positive attitude in the face of uncertainty led inevitably to ludicrous convictions about the divine origin of certain books, to bizarre cultural taboos, to the abject hatred of homosexuals, and to the diminished status of women. Adopt too positive an outlook, and the next thing you know, architects and engineers may start flying planes into buildings. As I do my best to spell out over the course of the book, religious faith is the belief in historical and metaphysical propositions without sufficient evidence. When the evidence for a religious proposition is thin or non-existent, or there is compelling evidence against it, people invoke faith. Otherwise, they simply cite the reasons for their beliefs. For example, the New Testament confirms Old Testament prophecy. I saw the face of Jesus in a window. We prayed, and our daughter's cancer went into remission. Such reasons are generally inadequate, but they are better than no reasons at all. People of faith naturally recognize the primacy of reasons and resort to reasoning whenever they possibly can. Faith is simply the license they give themselves to keep believing when reasons fail. When rational inquiry supports the creed, it is championed. When it poses a threat, it is derided, sometimes in the same sentence. Faith is the mortar that fills the cracks in the evidence and the gaps in the logic, and thus it is faith that keeps the whole terrible edifice of religious certainty still looming dangerously over our world. 3. Islam is no more amenable to violence than any other religion is. The violence we see in the Muslim world is the product of politics and economics, not faith. The speciousness of this claim is best glimpsed by the bright light of bomb blasts. Where are the Palestinian Christian suicide bombers? They too suffer the daily indignity of the Israeli occupation. Where, for that matter, are the Tibetan Buddhist suicide bombers? The Tibetans have suffered an occupation far more cynical and repressive than any that the United States or Israel has ever imposed upon the Muslim world. Where are the throngs of Tibetans ready to perpetrate suicidal attacks against Chinese non-combatants? They do not exist. What is the difference that makes the difference? The difference lies in the specific tenets of Islam. This is not to say that Buddhism could not help inspire suicidal violence. It can, and it has. Japan, World War II. But this concedes absolutely nothing to the apologists for Islam. As a Buddhist, one has to work extremely hard to justify such barbarism. One need not work nearly so hard as a Muslim. Recent events in Iraq offer further corroboration on this point. It is true, of course, that the Iraqi people have been traumatized by decades of war and repression. But war and repression do not account for suicidal violence directed against the Red Cross, the United Nations, foreign workers, and Iraqi innocents. War and repression would not have attracted an influx of foreign fighters willing to sacrifice their lives merely to sow chaos. The Iraqi insurgents have not been motivated principally by political or economic grievances. They have such grievances, of course, but politics and economics do not get a man to intentionally blow himself up in a crowd of children, or get his mother to sing his praises for it. Miracles of this order generally require religious faith. There are other confounding variables here, of course. State sponsorship of terrorism, the occasional coercion of reluctant suicide bombers. But we cannot let them blind us to the pervasive and lunatic influence of religious belief. The truth that we must finally confront is that Islam contains specific doctrines about martyrdom and jihad that now directly inspire Muslim terrorism. Unless the world's Muslims can find some way of expunging a theology that is fast turning their religion into a cult of death, we will ultimately face the same perversely destructive behavior throughout much of the world. Wherever these events occur, we will find Muslims tending to side with other Muslims, no matter how sociopathic their behavior. This is the malignant solidarity that religion breeds. It is time that sane human beings stopped making apologies for it, and it is time for Muslims, especially Muslim women, to realize that nobody suffers the consequences of Islam more than they do. 4. The End of Faith is not a truly atheistic book. It is really a stalking horse for Buddhism, New Age mysticism, or some other form of irrationality. As almost every page of my book is dedicated to exposing the problems of religious faith, it is ironic that some of the harshest criticism has come from atheists, who feel that I have betrayed their cause on peripheral issues. If there is a book that takes a harder swing at religion, I'm not aware of it. This is not to say that my book does not have many shortcomings, but appeasing religious irrationality is not among them. Nevertheless, atheists have found much to complain about in the book, especially in the last chapter, where I attempt to put meditation and spirituality on a rational footing. Meditation, in the sense that I use the term, merely requires that a person pay extraordinarily close attention to his moment-by-moment experience of the world. There is nothing irrational about doing this. In fact, it constitutes the only rational basis for making detailed claims about the nature of our subjectivity. Through meditation, a person can come to observe the flow of his experience with remarkable clarity, and this sometimes results in a variety of insights that people tend to find both intellectually credible and personally transformative. As I discuss in the final chapter of the book, one of these insights is that the feeling we call I, the sense that we are the thinker of our thoughts, the experiencer of our experiences, can disappear when looked for in a rigorous way. This is not a proposition to be accepted on faith. It is an empirical observation, analogous to the discovery of one's optic blind spots. Most people never notice their blind spots, caused by the transit of the optic nerve through the retina of each eye, but they can be pointed out to almost anyone with a little effort. The absence of the self can also be pointed out with some effort, though this discovery tends to require considerably more training on the part of both teacher and student. The only faith required to get such a project off the ground is the faith of scientific hypothesis. The hypothesis is this: if I use my attention in a certain way, it may have a specific, reproducible effect. Needless to say, what happens, or fails to happen, along any path of spiritual practice must be interpreted in light of some conceptual scheme, and everything should be open to rational argument. I have also taken considerable heat from atheists for a few remarks I made about the nature of consciousness. Most atheists appear to be certain that consciousness is entirely dependent on, and reducible to, the workings of the brain. In the last chapter of the book, I briefly argue that this certainty is unwarranted. The fact is that scientists still do not know what the relationship between consciousness and matter actually is. I am not suggesting that we make a religion out of this uncertainty, or do anything else with it. And, needless to say, the mysteriousness of consciousness does nothing to make conventional religious notions about God and paradise any more plausible. Since The End of Faith was first published, current events have remained a running confirmation of its central thesis. There are days when almost every headline in the morning paper attests to the social costs of religious faith, and the nightly news seems miraculously broadcast from the 14th century. One spectacle of religious hysteria follows fast upon the next. Sanctimonious eruptions announcing the death of the Pope, a man who actively opposed condom use in sub-Saharan Africa and shielded frocked child molesters from secular justice, are soon followed by other outbursts of religious lunacy. At the time of this writing, Muslims in several countries are rioting over a report that U.S. interrogators desecrated a copy of the Quran. 17 people are dead and hundreds injured. The response of the U.S. government has been to offer up some lunacy of its own. No less a spokeswoman than the Secretary of State has assured the righteous hordes that the United States government will not tolerate any disrespect for the Holy Quran. What form our government's intolerance will take remains unspecified. I await a knock on the door. Such perfect visions of unreason have been punctuated by the more ordinary trespasses of faith. Daily reports of pious massacres in Iraq, of evangelical ravings against the evils of a secular judiciary, of widespread religious coercion in the U.S. Air Force, of efforts in at least 20 states to redefine science to include supernatural explanations of the origin of life, of devout pharmacists refusing to fill prescriptions for birth control, of movie theaters refusing to show documentaries that report the actual age of the Earth, and on and on and onward to the 15th century. For anyone with eyes to see, there can be no doubt that religious faith remains a perpetual source of human conflict. Religion persuades otherwise intelligent men and women to not think or to think badly about questions of civilizational importance. And yet it remains taboo to criticize religious faith in our society, or to even observe that some religions are less compassionate and less tolerant than others. What is worst in us, outright delusion, has been elevated beyond the reach of criticism, while what is best, reason and intellectual honesty, must remain hidden for fear of giving offense. The end of faith represents my first attempts to call attention to the dangers and absurdities inherent in this situation. I sincerely hope that readers will continue to find the book useful. Sam Harris, New York, May 2005. This concludes the reading of The End of Faith, Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason by Sam Harris. This book was read by Brian Emerson. Copyright 2004 and 2005 by Sam Harris. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with W.W. Norton.